Okay, we started with the Agadah last time, and I do want to try, if possible, to finish this time. So in order to do that, we need somehow to get through all of the sources. So let's go from the beginning, and we'll see what we've done so far. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, and now, as I do it this time, we're already doing it because we already know Rashi, and now we already know the Arizal. So we're a lot smarter, hopefully, than we were last time. Correct? So we're all at the same place? Thank you. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, Rav Yehuda said to Rav, B'shasha ala Moshe l'marom, when Moshe went up above, Matzula Kadosh Baruch Hu sheyoshev v'kosher k'tarim la'otiyot, he found God sitting and tying crowns onto the letters. Amai lefanav, he said in front of him, Rabbona Shalola, master of the universe, Mima akeva yadcha, who's holding you back? Amai lo, he said, Adam echad yesh, there's one man, Shatid liot, who's going to live in the future, Besof kamadaro, to the end of many generations, V'akiva ben Yosef shmo, his name is Akiva the son of Yosef, Shatid ledrosh, akol kotz v'kotz, on each point, on each letter, he will be able to expound, Tilei tilim shalachot, mounds upon mounds of laws, and I pointed out last time that the word tel itself indicates various levels. Correct. Good. Amar lefanav, Moshe said in front of God, Ribono shel Olam, master of the universe, har ehuli, show him to me. Amar lo chazor la'acharecha, turn him back. He turns him back. Halach, he goes, v'yashav l'sof shmona, or shmona esrei shirot. He sits at the end of either the eighth or the eighth row. Or 18th row. And he did not understand what they were saying. He did not know what they were saying. Toshash kolcho, he lost his strength, or he became depressed. Kevin shegila davar, or davar echad, when he got to one particular point, Amru lo tamidav, his students, or Vakiva, asked him, Rabbi minayin lacha, how do you know this? Amar lehem alacha l'moshe misinai, I have this from Moshe at Sinai, netiash vedato, and Moshe felt better. So, initially when we looked at it, we decided that we had over here, we had confusion. And the confusion which Moshe has was our confusion as well. And it was a very basic question that if the Torah comes from Moshe and Moshe's in the future and Moshe's sitting in a Beit Midrash or classroom, why is it that Moshe doesn't understand? What we saw in Rashi was Rashi writes, Nityash Vodato, Moshe feels better, Shom Moshe, Hol Mishmo Omer, because it said in his name, Afapisha Dain Lo Kibla, even though he hadn't received it yet, which implies that according to Rashi, the entire episode takes place prior to Moshe having knowledge. If that's the case, then why should Moshe be depressed? If the implication is that Moshe is about to get all of this, so the depression is a little difficult to understand. And for that matter, why does he feel better if it's said in his name? I mean, and the story itself seems to be a little bit confusing. So, the paradox which existed is, if Moshe doesn't understand it, and Moshe is the source, right? So how could it be that Moshe doesn't understand it, and yet it's being said in Moshe's name? And that we found an explanation from the Arizal. And that explanation of Arizal is also is quoted afterwards by the Aruch Chaim and a number of others. The Arizal's interpretation, which really deals with knowledge to really great extent of knowledge, and I think it's very important for our generation, because in our generation, each one of you perhaps has an expertise, something that you actually know about, or maybe you're very adept at. And any idiot, no offense, can go on Google and look about and know all kinds of things about something that you know very well. And they'd know enough probably to make trouble, but not enough to be proficient whatsoever. I mean, you would probably not want someone to do surgery on you if you just looked up on Google how to do surgery. I mean, I would assume, maybe I'm wrong. But the amount of information somebody knows about something is not the same thing as depth of information. And I'm saying that's especially true now, where the amount of information in the world, I don't know how often they say, every 4 years at this point it doubles. Who knows who's actually looking at these things. But that the fact that Moshe knows more about something, sorry, the fact that Rabbi Akiva may know more, sounds like he knows more, does not mean that he knows better. I would give an analogy to this. Let's say, for example, that I wanted to teach to my students something which I heard from Rabbi Soloveitchik. More often than not to do that, and there's two ways of quoting Rabbi Soloveitchik. One way is just saying whatever you want to say and claim that he said it. But another way is you can turn something which Rabbi Soloveitchik said, and most things that he said were part of very long, involved discussions. I was in his Gemara Shir for 3 years, and I'm amazed at all the Vartlach that come out. The Rav didn't say Vartlach, and some people writing over the Shirim, they write it that way, because there's a problem that you want to try to break it up in order to try to make it something which is that an individual can understand. So if I wanted to teach something, the odds are with my students I could not quote it verbatim. And the other thing that I'd probably need to do is to give it an introduction to explain the general idea, maybe to add in some things by way of explanation, some examples and so on and so forth. And it could be that I would need to break it up sufficiently that if he himself were to walk in the room, it could be he would not know what I was talking about. But it's not that he wouldn't know what I'm talking about because I'm speaking on a higher level. It's quite the opposite takes place. So when you're teaching on a lower level, you generally need to break it up that much more. And I can really envision that taking place of somebody teaching over something which was, you know, and by the way, it could be something from Rabbi Soloveitchik, it could be Reb Chaim, it could be, and it can go on and on. I taught a Reb Chaim last week, and the Reb Chaim ended up being the point within a nafkamina. You know what nafkamina means? I don't know how to say it in English. It ended up being the practical distinction between how exactly you manufacture a Shabbos elevator. So I could very well understand Reb Chaim sitting there and saying, like, what is he talking about? But it goes back to a point that Reb Chaim made. I won't go into it. It's interesting, but I won't go into it. The Arizal's point was that Moshe knew written Torah, Moshe knew oral Torah. Moshe did not know how to derive the oral Torah from the written Torah. Does this indicate that Moshe is on a lower level? Quite the opposite. Moshe didn't need to know how to derive it. I also pointed out what I think is a huge distinction between how we learn versus how Moshe learned, if I'm not mistaken, that Moshe receives the oral Torah before he receives the written Torah. We study the written Torah, and then we go looking for the oral Torah. In Rabbi Akiva's generation, with all the cynicism which existed, Rabbi Akiva needed to try to show the validity and authenticity of the oral Torah, so he needs to show all the connections that take place. As far as I can tell, according to what the Rizal is telling us, that the crowns and the letters are something which are not part of the letters, something which is external to the letters, but it's something which is there, and that would be a metaphor for the drashot. That would be a metaphor for what Moshe doesn't know. But again, Moshe doesn't know it because he's on a higher level. Okay, so that's, I think, as far as we got last time. Correct? Yeah. So then Moshe goes back to God, and everything is good now. Everything works more or less. Till this point, Chazar ubalafnei Kadosh Baruch Hu, who goes back and he says to God, Amar lefanav, he says in front of him, Ribono shel Olam, Master of the Universe, Yesh lecha Adam kazeh, you have a man like this, v'ata noten Torah ayadi, and you give the Torah to me now. Moshe's feelings of inadequacy should not be surprising to us. Moshe always feels inadequate. Moshe not being the one who feels that he should be the leader, he should be the one to... Okay, that makes sense to us. That we understand. By the way, when God says to Moshe, I'll give you a sign. Remember when Moshe doesn't want to take them out? I'll give you a sign. What was the first sign that God gave him? By the way, and you know if I'm asking it, then you can get the wrong answer. What? Right, but that's not the first one. What was the first sign that he said? Okay, you want this for homework? No. The reason why you can't remember it... The reason why you can't remember it is because it doesn't... Because it uses the word oat. Zelecha oat. This is the oat. And then... Go ahead. Yeah, when you take them out, you'll serve God on this mountain. You say, what kind of an ode is that? It's not as exciting as the other one. I mean, turning a staff into a snake is pretty good. Right, having his hand, all that's pretty good, but that's when it says, this is a lecha'ot, this is the sign. When you take them out, you'll serve God on this mountain. Which may very well be that Moshe's argument is, who am I? I'm not articulate. I'm not a wonderful leader. I can't give these rousing speeches. But God says to him, no, what is your job? What are you good at? What are you good at? Which means, do we remember Moshe as Moshe? Do we call him Moshe Mishichenu? Moshe Goaleinu? In fact, we work very, very hard not to say that. What do we call him? Moshe Rabbeinu. So what is God's response? Yeah, it's true. He says, I'm not a good leader, I'm not articulate. Correct. But what are you good at? You'll be a very good teacher. Right? When this is the sign. The sign that you were chosen is that when you take them out, then by Har Sinai, you're the one who's going to end up teaching them Torah. Which again, to us, you say, that's the convincing argument at the end. Over here, when Moshe sees another teacher, when Moshe sees Rabbi Akiva, Moshe says, hold it a second. What he can do is apparently what the people will one day need. So then again, he goes back to the same point. So why should I be the one to give the Torah? You should be really giving to someone like this who can provide the needs that which really will be there at some point. So all that works out well and everything makes sense, and then we get stuck. Because God's response is, Amar lo shtok kach Allah b'machshava lefanai. Now, the word shtok, I always translate as shut up, because that's the way it's normally said to me. And it's a little unfair. Whether the word as it's used today, shtok, is the same way that it's used in Talmudic times, that we have to be a little bit careful. It certainly means not to speak. The question is, does it mean shh, or is it said with gusto? So that's a little bit harder. And by the way, that's always the challenge when reading texts. The challenge always going to be, what is the tone of voice being used? And that's something that we have to constantly ask ourselves as reading, okay, what? Not just what is being said, how is it being said? Because sometimes how it being said then tells you what is being said. So I would, and I know it bothers us. What bothers all of us is the same thing, is that we would like to believe that when we ask God a question, and God is already there, and God is already in the room, and God is already responding, we would like the response to be very warm and fuzzy. And over here, instead, what we're getting is something which is, again, once again, enigmatic. And then that's what this whole passage is full of enigma. So let's say for a moment that it's more of the shh than the, doesn't help us that much. Now, one person who did try to use this and explain it in a fashion which I think is completely wrong, and I'll explain in a moment, was Rabbi Nachman from Breslov. Rabbi Nachman, who had a whole theology of silence, he thought silence was very good. Okay, I think some of you can appreciate that. Again, just to understand where Rabbi Nachman is coming from. The difference between man and between animals is that man has what's called by the Targum the Ruach Melalala, this ability to speak. So therefore the distinction is that we're able to take letters and turn them into words and words into sentences and sentences into articulate communication. And it could be that animals can get out some kind of sounds, but it's not words, it's not speech. So therefore, what makes man great is the ability to speak. Rabbi Nachman believes what makes man even greater is the ability to shut up. to refrain from speaking. And therefore, for example, the question that all of you may have asked yourselves last week, when Avram is marching up towards the Akedah, and he's silent, Rabbi Nachman sees within Avraham's silence the greatness of Avraham. When Aharon is silent and doesn't speak, Rabbi Nachman sees the greatness of Aharon. For Rabbi Nachman to take speech, which is words, and turn it into a niggun. Why is a niggun so good? Because it's song but without words. So a song without words is something which is divine. Dancing to a niggun, to Rabbi Nachman, I'm not going to talk with a Sefer Torah without, okay? So dancing to a niggun for Rabbi Nachman is actually the image of the angels on the sulam. What's the exact description of the angels? What does it say? Olim v'yordim. So he sees them dancing. That's what dancing is, olim v'yordim. So therefore, Rabbi Nachman, again, has this whole theology of silence, and therefore over here, he has God saying to Moshe, shtok, be silent, kach alei, he just changed that a little bit, ever so slightly, kach alei b'machshava lefanai. That's how you can rise up and understand my thought. If you want to understand me, be quiet. So that's how Rabbi Nachman would explain this. Do you like it? Why don't you like it? That's not good.
It doesn't fit into the story.
Okay, A doesn't fit into the story. Because any time you have to change a word, it doesn't work. Unless you're a chassid, then it works. So any of you have chassidish and neshamas, then you should be ecstatic. You can get up and dance right now if you want. But be quiet. You can't change the word. The phrase itself, kach ala b'machshava, is something which is a well-known phrase. This is not the only time that it appears. It's not the only time that it appears. So to change it, that's the problem with it. It's not that you like something else better. That's irrelevant. That's irrelevant. I'll say it again. It's irrelevant that you like another one better. What's relevant is that it's a very nice explanation, but not of our passage. Because again, if you have to change it around a little bit, so then if you need to say over a vart, then you're set. But it doesn't... And it's very nice. It's very nice to connect it with the Akkad and to connect it with Vayidom Aaron and also, I mean, there's many things to connect over there. But as I said, it doesn't work. Yes?
Where's the language coming from?
Well, first of all, it comes from this text right here. But where else is it? It's also in Medrash Rambam. And it's quoted by Rashi, not in the most obscure place in the world. Rashi on the end of page number 2 in source number 10. Rashi quotes it on actually the very first verse in the Torah. So those of you who started doing Rashi and Chumash this year, well, I don't know how far you got. Bereshit bara Elokim. Okay, let's stop a little bit, but before we look at the Rashi, you're already looking too late. But let's wait and let's see first what exactly is the issue. There are many names of God used in the Chumash. The names of God are incredibly important. I'll just put it this way. If this was the issue that the Bible critics jumped upon, the different names of God, therefore would indicate different authors, and different authors indicate different documents, and so on and so forth. And we actually, believe it or not, Chazal noticed that there are different names, right? And the objection of the Bible critic seems to be more one of doctrine than anything else. I mean, what do I mean by one of doctrine? Is that they don't tend to look at the book in terms of theological reading because they don't take it seriously enough to see theology. So in terms of which name is being used, that's incredibly significant. But let me back up a second. This I enjoyed asking my 18-year-old students last week. Is it possible to refer or to address the same person in different ways? And what would the different ways indicate? So in order to illustrate this point, I asked my 18-year-old students who are female, I said, what do you call your father? And they call me a bunch of names. I said, what do you call him when you want money? And suddenly there was a different name or a more endearing name which was used. Yes, you've all been manipulated, but you probably enjoy it, so it's okay. Different names indicate different types of relationships. That's not earth-shattering. It's not like if somebody comes over and calls me Ari and somebody else calls me Rabbi, you're not going to say, well, make up your mind, who is he? No, so it could be that there are different relationships going on. And I said, this is not something which really would concern us at all. The fact that different names are used in the Torah to describe God, Chazal tell us, indicates different relationships. Okay, so again, this is ABC, you all know this already. The name, well, maybe what you don't know. which name of God is the real name of God? And which name of God is just being used in other types of ways? That's a far more difficult question, but I think that there's an obvious answer to it. Which name is more of a, is the essence, and which is a name, which are names of indicating different types of relationships? So I'll help you with that. We have two major names. One name is Yud He Vav He, and the other name is Elokim. Elokim is said to be Midat HaDin, and Yud He Vav He is said to be Midat HaRachamim. Okay, which is the reality? Now stop before you answer. Is God really Midat HaDin, but he uses Rachamim around long enough just to keep us here so he can keep on punishing us? Or is God really Midat HaRachamim and he uses Din because that's something which we need? Or is God perhaps bipolar and there's real no one understanding of God? So which one is it? Well, you choose not to choose. Okay, so let's go back again. The name of God. Okay, we'll come back to that in a second. The name of God, Elokim, what does it mean? Which means I have to translate it in English. And by the way, a lot of people don't like that. So you shouldn't translate it. But if I had to translate Elokim, how would I translate it in English? And moreover, why is it plural? Right? Why is it plural? So now I'll say again. How would you translate Elokim?
The Almighty.
The Almighty, right? Which means it's plural because it's God possessing all power. Right? The plurality isn't about God. The plurality is on the power. So why is that connected to Midat HaDin? Okay. So pause a second. The name Yud Kei Vav Kei means Hoya Hoveviyah. If I had to translate it into English, I would write the Eternal. If I had to translate Elokim, I'd write the Almighty. And it actually, in my book, I'm pretty consistent on that, right? Yeah, we're pretty consistent on that. And that itself is not a simple point. Whether you should do it at all or just write God. More often than not, I think with Yud Kei Vav Kei, we just put in God. But there were some times, if it was in one sentence, you would write the Almighty God. But Yud Kei Vav Kei means the Eternal. So as I said, most times in a translation, you don't need to write it that way, even though I'm saying that's what it means. Okay, so now I'm going to ask again the question, which is God's essence and which is God using? So the fact that Yud Kei Vav Kei means Ho-Yehovah V'yiyah, that means that it's transcendental, that means that it's outside of context, that means that that's the essence. Elokim is being used in certain contexts, and the context that it's used, so therefore... Okay, good. So, let's look at the Rashi now, keeping this in mind. And what's bothering Rashi is very, very simple. Is that the creation of the world, Bereshit Bara, now we have two possibilities. It could be Bereshit Bara, Yud Kei Vav Kei, or it can have Bereshit Bara, Elokim. So if it was Yud Kei Vav Kei, then the whole foundation of the world presumably would a foundation of, back to those warm fuzzy things, that God is full of kindness and so on and so forth. But if the foundation of the world is Din, so then we perhaps are in a great deal of trouble. So Rashi writes, Bara Elokim. And the end of page 2, source 10. Rashi writes, Bara Elokim. Vilo Amar Bara Hashem. And it doesn't say Yud Kei Vav Kei. So now you realize what I was telling you. That's exactly the issue which is concerning Rashi. Shebitchila Allah b'machshava. Now you notice the term that we were looking for. Shebitchila originally Allah b'machshava livroto b'midat hadin. That God's original thought was to create b'midat hadin. By the way, now we know the answer to our question. When it says, Kach Allah b'machshava, this is my first thought, we now know what God's first thought is. God's first thought is to create the world out of justice. Now it continues and says, Ra'ash ein olam mitkayem. God saw that the world would not be sustained, a world created upon justice. Hikdim midat rachamim v'shatva l'midat hadin. Therefore God took midat rachamim and preceded it to midat hadin. He put compassion before justice. Hainu d'chtiv, and that's why when we get to the retrospective of creation, in the second chapter it says, B'yom asot Hashem Elokim eretz Hashemayim, the day that Hashem Elokim created heaven and earth. Now, this Rashi should trouble all of you. even after the explanation, should trouble all of you. What should have it said, therefore, in the first pasuk? Bereshit bara should have said Hashem Elokim. Which means, after Rashi finishes explaining, so now we realize, yeah, this is a problem. It should have said, Bereshit bara Hashem Elokim et Hashemayim et Haaretz. That's what it should have said. And what we're left with, after all the finesse, we're left now confused. Okay, that was such a good explanation, so why does it say it the way that it does? So I don't want to go into this more than necessary. You whispered under your breath there.
I'm scared of you.
Good. No, I mean you shouldn't be. You whispered under your breath the concept of tzimtzum. Tzimtzum means, somehow it means self-limitation. And that is absolutely, as far as the Kabbalists are concerned, the significance of this particular verse. And so much so that in the Tikkuni Zohar, there is, how should I describe this? There's a brazen interpretation of this pasuk. There's actually lots of them in Tikkuni Zohar. That's the whole Tikkuni Zohar is explanations of this pasuk. But there is a brazen interpretation that says, Bereshit bar Elokim, in the beginning, God, Yudke Vavke, created Elokim. Bereshit bara Elokim, that the first thing that God created was Elokim. And you say, hold it a second, what does that even mean? So it means exactly what I was saying before. Yud Kei Vav Kei is transcendent. Yud Kei Vav Kei Ha Yehovah V'Yia always exists. Elokim is something which was created. Now, how is Elokim created, or what is Elokim? So Elokim is Midat Hadin. So before there was an other, when there was only God, Yud Kei Vav Kei, when there was only God, there was no other, there's no need for justice. The creation of man is what necessitates a necessity for justice. Meaning that is part of creation. So therefore, there has to be a process. It has to be, in the very beginning, Bereshit bara Elokim. We need there to be Elokim as the foundation. That is what's called the tzimtzum sometimes, that's the self-limitation. That's where the eternal God allows us to live in a fantasy and make believe that God doesn't exist. Yes? Or make believe that he's not watching, or make believe there's no consequences for actions. Which means, without this, we would not really have free will. So to have free will, God has to make believe that we're on our own. God makes believe that we're on, now we can do things. We can do things now, we need justice. Which means, this idea, where Yudke Vavke is being mitzamtzem, self-limitation, as it were, that is exactly where Elokim is introduced. Did any of that make any sense? Yes or no?
Yes. I'm a little confused.
You're allowed to be.
Because my understanding is, the way I've always understood this, in a general sense, is that the din comes first, and then it's realized we need rachamim.
Right. The din comes first, but the din comes first only in terms of our existence. But prior to existence, there was only Yudke Vavke. And I'll go back again, because Yudke Vavke was, is, and will be. It always existed. Elokim is something which makes an appearance over here in the beginning, but this is the beginning, which is the beginning of a limitation. The world itself is created. God exists outside of time. So outside of time is Yudke Vavke. Elokim is something which is within time because there is this other. What have we gained from all of this? Well, we've gained one very specific point, and what is that? That now we know that when we hear over here in our text, Bereshit bar Elokim, and it means that God's original thought was to create the world with din, we now know what God's original thought is. What's God's original thought? The use of justice. If you had the Ein Yaakov, right, the Iyun Yaakov, which was a commentary on the Ein Yaakov, if you had it in front of you, which you don't, you will find that he connects our passage right back with this Rashi. He lived a little bit earlier than the Maharal, so the Maharal in source number 11 will do the same thing for us, but the Maharal, as I said, is not the first one to do it. He does it on this passage, while the Iyun Yaakov did it on our passage. Source 11, Sha'ala b'machshava ve'im tomar ma'da hava hava, whatever was. Ma'ichpat b'zeh. What difference does it make to us if that was God's original thought? V'yesh lomar, we can explain, shabala gidlacha, that it comes to teach us, shetov hu la'adam shia omeid b'midat hadin. It's good for a person to be able to stand up to God's original thought, to God's justice. V'she'ein tzarech l'midat rachamim. It's good when a person does not necessarily need compassion. That was God's original intention, or will, as it were, to create a world with justice. Therefore, you see, that is God's desire and will. Because the world couldn't be sustained, but Rabbi Midat HaRachim, and therefore he created it with compassion. And praise or is the person who's able to stand up to God's justice who does not start God's justice who does not need compassion. Now, as far as I'm concerned, this explanation of the Maharal, as I said, it's really the Iyun Yaakov, works beautifully back into our passage. Let's try now to work it through. And the only question in my mind is, should we try to work it through the first time God says it or the second time that God says it? Let's do the second one, and then we'll go back to the first. The second time he says it is when Moshe says to God, "You've shown me his Torah, can I see his reward?" And what does God do? He shows him something which is absolutely grotesque. He shows him Akiva's lifeless body. And as we decided last time, God was being deliberately difficult when he shows him what he shows him. He could easily have showed him Rabbi Akiva's death scene, which was inspiring. Yes, inspiring. He could easily have shown him the next scene, Rabbi Akiva's soul soaring up into heaven, and he doesn't show him that. Instead, he shows him Rabbi Akiva's body, right, body, mutilated body without a soul, which, which may very well be a metaphor for the Torah without the crowns. Seeing the body without this, I didn't say it, so I said it now. I'm allowed to say new things now. A lot of things I didn't say. Yes?
Could this story really be not so much about Moshe Rabbeinu, but really be about Rabbi?
Of course it is. Hold on one second. I'll come back to you. Of course it is, but hold on for 1 second. Therefore, when we get to this point, that we see Rabbi Akiva's lifeless body, Moshe again says, "Zu Torah v'zu Schara, this is Torah and this is its reward." What's God's response at that point? Shtok, kach Allah b'machshav lefanai. This is my original thought. Now, the way that we now understand it, it's not God saying, so sue me, right? It's not God just being difficult. He's giving a response. And what's the response? No. What's the response that he's saying now? Rabbi Akiva is being treated by Midat Hadin. When most people have Midat Hadin and Midat Rachamim, Rabbi Akiva is being treated by pure Midat Hadin. And therefore, what you're seeing, it really is the reward, as it were, the greatness of Rabbi Akiva, that he's being treated by pure Midat Hadin. Now, so I cut you off terribly now. Okay, good. I'll tell you exactly when it was written, because that's very important. What was the source of the story? It was Rav Yehud, the name of Rav. So, who is Rav? Where did he live? And when did he live? That was a question, by the way. What?
You told us 1,400 years after
Moshe. No, Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is. No, Rabbi Akiva is.
Yeah.
What? Good. Rav is one of the first generation Amorim in Bavel, but there's another part of Rav's biography which I think is very important. Rav actually did something which many people do, still today. Rav came to learn in Eretz Yisrael. As a young man, Rav came to learn in Eretz Yisrael. He was born in Bavel, came to Eretz Yisrael, and he learned over here. He learned with Yehuda Nasi. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi died around approximately the year 220. I cannot tell you how long Rav was here, how long he studied with him, but we can begin to approximate, but let's just say, to round it out, we can say that Rav was here around the year 200. Okay? Could it be 180? It could be 180. It could be 182. But you realize that's the ballpark. Rabbi Akiva died approximately, we don't know the exact year, Rabbi Akiva died presumably during the Bar Kochba Rebellion. But as I said, we don't know exactly the year when he died. So presumably Rabbi Akiva would have died around the year 135, 137, give or take. Which means the odds that Rav would have met people who met Rabbi Akiva was great. some old timers that he met would have met Rabbi Akiva. So I don't know how much in the future you imagine that to be, so I'm just pointing out that Rav, when he comes to Israel, does meet people who were impacted by Rabbi Akiva. He certainly meets students of his students, that, without any question whatsoever. He meets students of the students. The students of Rabbi Akiva, the latter students who survive, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda Ben Eli, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, right? These students of Rabbi Akiva, if they are not, we don't know exactly when each dies, if they're not around, their students are definitely around. So therefore, the contribution of Rabbi Akiva will be very, very well within the mind of Rav. Now let's leave that out there for a moment, and let's what?
Rav isn't telling the story. This is Rabbi Yehuda.
Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rabbi Yehuda heard the story from his teacher Rav. So the person. Well, he's just telling what he heard. The person who makes up this story, or the person who reports this story, however you want, the earliest that we can go back is to Rav. Whether, as I said last time, whether Rav heard this or learned this, whatever, Rav is the one who reports this story. So that's as far back as we can go with confidence. And if you want to go all the way back and say that Moshe learned this story at Sinai, I'm fine with that. But I'm just saying that as far as we can go back is to Rav. So now let's pause for a second. When we look now at the very end of the story, we now come to this realization that Shto Kach Alav Machshava Lefanai is no longer God just being difficult and saying, well, that's what I decided, you know, that was my decision, and that's it. It's actually, there's an answer over here, and the answer is God saying, I am using over here Midat Hadin, which therefore tells us that Rabbi Akiva was being treated by Midat Hadin, and had there been some Midat HaRachamim, then the whole story would have been different. You know, for example, you're familiar with this. You're familiar with this in a completely different complexion, but it's a very similar thing, and that is on Yom Kippur, when we tell the story of the 10 martyrs, of which Rabbi Akiva is one of them. And there as well, it's questioned, you know, there it's connected with the Mechirat Yosef, and it's questioned, this is what I heard on the other side of the Pargod. This is God's will. Is it one that they deserve this? On some level, there was deserving. Again, it's very interesting. On some level, Am Yisrael deserved this. Do we understand what level? It's what I heard on the other side of the Pargod. It's what I heard something coming from heaven. There was such a thing as Mechirat Yosef once. And because there was Mechirat Yosef, these are the people who are so great. So therefore, on some level, it's being described as a Midat Hadin. One second. Is that the strictest Midat Hadin you've ever heard? Of course it is. Because Midat Hadin normally would be that I'm responsible for what I did without any mitigating circumstances. And over here, these 10 are being judged by something which their ancestors did. And normally, we don't punish descendants for the sins of the ancestors unless they're doing the exact same thing. So over here, the whole use of Midat Hadin within the story of the Aserah Hurigei Malchut is not all that different from what this Gemara is telling us again over here, that Rabbi Akiva is being treated by Midat Hadin. Which then leads me to the next obvious observation. And who else is being treated with Midat Hadin? What was Moshe's terrible sin that he did that the God said, that's it, game over, don't pass go, don't call, don't... Right. Which, again, let's be honest, it does not necessarily sound, meaning, like the worst sin. As we're reading the text, unless you've read it before, you're very surprised when you see the response. You think that as we're reading over there, this is okay. And especially when you compare what's written in Parashat Chukat together with what's written in Parashat Beshalach, it seems real similar. Okay, take he didn't say Simon Says. I didn't say, I said to take the staff, I didn't say to use the staff. That's it. Which means there really does seem to be over here an incredible use of Midat Hadin as well, which applies to Moshe. The reason I'm pointing this out is because I think that's exactly what the text is trying to teach us, but I'm getting slightly ahead of myself. Let's take a look at the first time that it's used. Moshe's objection is, you have a man as great as this, why are you giving the Torah to me? And on a certain level, we understand that objection. And on a certain level, we understand that there never would have been a Rebbe Akiva had there not been a Moshe beforehand. And we realize that there's a necessity. But if, and maybe this is not fair, you can tell me afterwards you don't think it's fair what I'm saying right now. If we look this in more Kabbalistic terms, then if Moshe's job is to give the Torah to the Jewish people, on some level he fails his job. Now, you can say that I'm not being fair when I say that, and I'm not being fair when I say that, but nonetheless, that's what we're reading over here. That isn't Moshe's job. Moshe's the lawgiver. Moshe's the one who brings the Torah down from heaven. Moshe's the one who gives it to Am Yisrael. And now we learn when we go into the future that ultimately Moshe did not succeed in giving it the way that Am Yisrael is going to need. And you could tell me for all kinds of reasons, because the people are on a lower level, and you could say that's not a fair analysis. But if, and this is a frightening thought, if Moshe, on whatever level it is, does not complete his life's task, so then what does this mean for the rest of us? Perhaps. But that brings me back to the point how it's being used over here. Kach ala b'machshav lefanai, where the answer over here is that Moshe's not completing his task is only when you look at it in the most extreme midat hadin. Now, I want to use this to now explain everything that we haven't explained yet in the story and all the missing details and what I think is going on. What was strange that we haven't answered yet?
The 18th.
Okay, so let's start with that. The 8th or the 18th row. The 8th, especially if we go to the Maharal, but he's not the first, he just popularized it. It's in many sources before. The number 8 always symbolizes Lamala Teva, which means that is Moshe in the room or not in the room? Moshe's not in the room. Is that Moshe is actually Besof? At the end of the 8th row, number 8 is always the supernatural, the metaphysical. Moshe is not really there. If it's the 18th, what does 18 symbolize? The number 18 is Chai, which means that whenever we teach Torah, Moshe is really in the room. Which means it comes back to the same point that there is, meaning even though Moshe feels this inadequacy, whenever Torah is being taught, Moshe is really there on some level. So that's what I think both the 8th and or the 18th will symbolize. I want to go back to Rav. A number of you already said correctly. As a matter of fact, I said it also last week, and it was also correct. And that is that this story is not about Moshe. The story is about Rabbi Akiva. Of course, the interesting thing is that Moshe is the main protagonist, and Rabbi Akiva is silent. But if you take a look at the two of them, it's very clear that Rabbi Akiva is on a higher pedestal within this story than Moshe is. Moshe is confused, Rabbi Akiva has understanding. Moshe is going back and forth. Rabbi Akiva is the one who is really, who the story is really about. I want to go back to Rav now, because I think that that's exactly what Rav was grappling with. And again, I'll go either way that Rav made this up or Rav heard this. It makes no difference to me. But I think it's significant that Rav is the one who explains it. When Rav comes to Eretz Yisrael from Bavel, and by the way, don't forget something. There was a larger Jewish community in Bavel during this time than there was in Eretz Yisrael. We like to believe there was a far more important community in Eretz Yisrael, but there was a large community in Bavel at the time as well. Rav comes to Eretz Yisrael, and again, I'm not sure to what extent you're really focused on this. The Mishnah that we have is the notes of Rabbi Meir based on the lectures of Rabbi Akiva, as published by Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who he studies with. Which means the source of the Mishnah that we have, it is Rabbi Akiva. The source of the Tosefta that we have, it is from Rabbi Akiva. The source of the Sifri and the Sifra is from Rabbi Akiva. Which means all of Rabbi Akiva's students are the ones who are teaching, and basically, you look around and say, who is the hero of Torah Shebal Peh? And without any question, the hero of Torah Shebal Peh is Rabbi Akiva. Okay, that's easy. And then you hear that not only was Rabbi Akiva the greatest scholar of his age, he also was the most important political leader of the age as well in terms of the whole involvement of the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. So here you have a man who's both a scholar and involved in politics, and that's not a very simple... And then you hear one more thing about him. He didn't start learning Torah until he was 40 years old. And by the way, at that point it becomes completely preposterous. And I'm saying that's an absurdity. How is it possible for somebody to have such an unbelievable impact, didn't have a start in learning Torah until such a late date, has the impact that he has, that basically he's the one who gave Torah Shebal Peh to Am Yisrael, in terms of the form that Rav witnesses or learns while he's there. And Rav has a very, very simple answer to explain all the phenomena. And the answer that he has is that Rabbi Akiva is the continuation of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now that may not be very clear to some of you. I'll make it very clear. That may not be very clear to some of you. Let's look at the first phenomenon that takes place. When God says to Moshe to look at him, what does he say to him? Does he say, go into the future, which he should say to him? What does he say instead? Chazor la'acharecha. Right. Which means? Chazor la'acharecha. Chazor la'acharecha. It's actually the opposite of what it should be saying. It's a complete opposite there. Going back of yourself. Chazor la'acharecha.
See who came after.
Chazor la'acharecha, I'm saying itself, is extremely interesting. Now, a number of authorities have noticed something, and this goes all the way back to, will be the Sifri. The Sifri in source number 12 sets up the parallel between Moshe and a number of great scholars. Umoshe ben Me'a ve'esrim shana, ze echod mi arba'a shemetu ben Me'a ve'esrim shana, ve'elu hei Moshe ve'hilal hazaken, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai ve'Rabbi Akiva. Now if you think about it, quite a list, and all that list has something in common. They are basically the major heroes of Torah Shebal Peh. Moshe ya b'mitzrayim arba'im shana, Moshe was 40 years old in Egypt, u'b'midyan arba'im shana, u'pirnes et Yisrael arba'im shana. And he then led the Jewish people for 40 years. We'll skip towards the third line from the bottom. Rabbi Akiva lamad Torah ben arba'im shana. He started learning when he was 40. V'shimesh et hachamim arba'im shana. And he learned for 40 years. He served. U'pirnes et Yisrael arba'im shana. And then for 40 years, he ended up leading the Jewish people. This midrash is creating a direct parallel between Moshe and Rabbi Akiva. And that, as I said, is not an accident. Because of this source, a number of the Kabbalistic sources, again, we can start off with source 14, if you will. This is the Seder HaDarot, who is just collecting from others. Rabbi Akiva nitzutz Moshe. He's a spark of Moshe. Okay, that, by the way, should be enough for you. Shar HaGilgulim, in source number 17. Shar HaGilgulim, for those of you who don't have one at home, is from the students of the Arizal, from Chaim Vital, and it's a book about reincarnations. Although the word reincarnation is not the right word. It's more of a transmigration, if that does anything for you. And the secret behind those who lived 120 years, Moshe Yochman Zakev, Rabbi Akiva, he skipped Hillel. Moshe Asa Arbim Shana Bebeit Paro, Arbaim, that is, Parneset Yisrael, Rabbi Yochman Zakev, Rabbi Akiva, Arbim Shana Am Haaretz Haya, Arbim Shana Lamad, Arbim Shana Limeid, Vinyan Kishora Nishamot Elu, Yeshlam Achiza, Veshechut Vikurva, Imosh Rabbeinu Olav Shalom, Kikola Nishamot Klolotbo, Ubaprat Nishamot Tzadikim. I'm not going to explain too much, but it is what he's saying over here is very clear, that the Nishama of Rabbi Akiva really is somehow connected in a profound way with the same neshama of Moshe Rabbeinu. And as I said, if I'm not mistaken, this is exactly what Rav was trying to teach us. As I said, the Sifri is an earlier source from Rav. The Sifri that sets up the parallel was already there. What I want to show is maybe one more thing, which I think may be a clinching argument into this whole analysis. And then maybe give us even more insight. Moshe Rabbeinu, his sin, which God treats him with incredible midat hadin, is when he was told to speak to the rock and he hits the rock. He's supposed to take water out of the rock. Instead of speaking to it, he hits it, water comes out of the rock, and at that point, that's it. What are the words that God uses? Over there? You did not create a kiddush Hashem, which means that instead what do you have? You have a chilul Hashem, and therefore you cannot continue. If you'll notice source 13, which again I hope or suspect that some of you have heard before, on the words in Pirkei Avot, Vishama Bitzamat Divrehim, this is called Avot Rebbe Natan. Avot Rebbe Natan is as close as we have to like a Gemara, what's more like Breitot or Tosefta, on Pirkei Avot. So it explains about what does it mean you should drink thirstily at their words of the Chachamim. Who really is the one who does this more than anybody else? Who personifies this trait? Vishotet Tzma et Divrehim, Ze Rebbe Akiva. Maya Tchilatosh Rebbe Akiva, what was the beginning of Rebbe Akiva? Amru was said, Ben Arbaim Shana Hayavalo Shana Klom, and that's what we just learned. He's 40 years old and not learned a word. Pamachariya Omed Al Pia Be'er, he's one standing in front of a well. Amar, and he says, Michacha Gevenzu, what caused there to be a hole in this rock? Amru, somebody says to him, Lo Amayim Shatadir Noflam Alea B'chol Yom, isn't it the water that drips on it every day? Amrulo Akiva, Iyata Kore Avanim Shachakumayim Akiva, don't you know the verse, water erode stones? Miyada Yerubi Akiva Dan Kalvachoma Ba'atzmo, Marach Pasalata Kashe, Divrei Torah Shakasha Kabarzel, Lachat Kalvachama, Shechkut Libishu Basavadam, Miyad Chazar Lomod Torah. That Rabbi Akiva's origins as a student of being involved in Torah were told in this source. He's 40 years old, has not learned a word. Rabbi Akiva knows nothing about Torah, and he sees a phenomenon. The phenomenon that he sees a rock, and the rock has a hole in it, and he questions, how did the rock get a hole in it? So it's the water which drips on it every day. Did you notice this? That Rabbi Akiva's end takes place when he hits the rock to take the water out of the rock. Rabbi Akiva begins when he sees the water going into the rock. That, as far as I can tell, this would be an indication of the continuation of Moshe with Rabbi Akiva. How does... It was worth coming for that?
It's beautiful.
Thank you. Can I have that in writing afterwards? And then when you come to the realization that Rabbi Akiva dies al Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name, so then you realize what Rav is seeing over here. He sees Rabbi Akiva as the one who continues Moshe's life and elevates Moshe's soul. And again, does Moshe's soul really need to be elevated? Only if you look at the world through pure Midat Hadin. You look at exclusive, pure Midat Hadin, so then you can say, Kach Allah b'machshava lefanai. Which means as much as God is talking to Moshe about Rabbi Akiva, God is also talking to Moshe about Moshe. Again, according to this Agadah. And I'll go back to the beginning. The real hero in the Agadah is Rabbi Akiva. But the reason that Rabbi Akiva is the hero is because Rabbi Akiva is continuing what Moshe Rabbeinu began. And that's exactly what I think Rav is trying to communicate. He sees somebody who's so great, and he sees the works of Rabbi Akiva, he sees the students of Rabbi Akiva, he sees the actions of Rabbi Akiva, he hears the stories, he hears the legends, and he comes to one, there's only one possible conclusion. I know that this is not the only one possible conclusion you would have come to necessarily. He says there's only one possible conclusion. And what's that? That Rabbi Akiva is in actuality somebody who had the neshama of Moshe Rabbeinu, because other than having that type of a neshama, how can I possibly explain, in a rational sense, all of the phenomenon? Again, sometimes, exactly, in a rational sense, sometimes the only rational explanation is something which is completely non-rational, because there's no other way of explaining the phenomenon that he sees. And therefore, what this whole Agadah is trying to explain is exactly how Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't stop right there, and therefore Moshe goes up again for revelation, and he comes down and he sees Rabbi Akiva, and that's where the revelation ends up coming to. But of course, this whole connection between Moshe and Akiva is not as strange as maybe we thought when we first understood it. And the fact that Moshe doesn't understand, Rabbi Akiva does understand, that's okay. That's okay, because Moshe understands what Moshe needs to understand, and Rabbi Akiva understands, bless you, what he needs to understand, and Moshe does what he needs to do, and Rabbi Akiva does what he needs to do. But what we end up understanding then is that these two great leaders of Am Yisrael, or at least according to these mystical, and what I suggested as well in terms of the rock, they're connected on a much more profound level than we ever would have noticed before, and that's exactly what Rav is trying to do by bringing them together. And again, the key, let's go back and see what we did today. The main thing that we did today was, again, the first breakthrough was the realization that Kach Olah B'Machshava Lefanai was not just trying to push away, but was actually a response. Because the first time we read it, we decided, okay, he's not answering. Kach Olah B'Machshava Lefanai, that's what I decided. Then when we looked to other places that it's used, and again, that's a very important point in terms of methodology. Sometimes you don't know what a particular word or line or phrase means in one context, so what do you need to do? You need to look in other contexts where it's used in order to get insight into it. So over here, instead of just giving up and or as Rabbi Nachman, just changing it into something else, we found another place that it was used, and the reality is that really was quite instructive. And the other place we came to this realization, as Rashi clearly stated,
that Rashi came after this.
Rashi's explaining the Midrash. Rashi's almost word for word the Midrash. I'm sorry. I could have brought Midrash Rabbah over here.
Okay.
Yeah, it's in Midrash Rabbah, where Rashi's quoting over here. So, it's okay. that what we saw, I mean, whenever possible, I know it doesn't look this way, but whenever possible, I try to use sources which are more well-known and popular than not go to the obscure ones. It's when I can't find the well-known ones, then you go.
Logically, Rashi is.
Yeah, I knew that. Anyway, as I said, Rashi over here is quoting from Medrash Rabbah. Okay, I could provide you the exact source if you need it. So realizing how Kachal B'Machshava is used, we then come to the realization that it is an answer, but it's Midat Hadin. That's what it is. God's original thought is Midat Hadin. So therefore, God is answering. We saw that specifically when we looked at the end of the story, where Moshe says, this is Torah and this reward. No, this is the reward. How is this the reward? Because Akiva is being treated in the strictest sense. Once we realized that Rabbi Akiva was being treated in the strictest sense, then we went back and we said, hold it. Moshe was also treated in the strictest sense. In which episode? Well, specifically the episode of him hitting the rock instead of speaking to the rock. Right? Then we went back and started thinking, okay, now what was Rav trying to communicate with this story? And the realization is that the connection between Rabbi Akiva and Moshe was much more profound than we thought, and that we saw black and white in the Sifri, again, which is a pretty old source. The Sifri was setting up the parallel between the life of Rabbi Akiva and others and the life of Moshe Rabbeinu by telling us how their lives were broken up. Yeah.
Perhaps further support for this would be the contra positive, in the sense that one of the explanations for why Moshe passed away before Bnei Yisrael were brought into Eretz Yisrael was because otherwise there wouldn't be a B'chiyah L'dorot, because had Moshe Bnei Yisrael went into Eretz Yisrael and had he built the Beit Hamikdash, then there wouldn't have been an opportunity to destroy it. And because of the students of Rabbi Akiva,
correct,
and the Sinat Chinam that was engendered during their generation, there was a...
Right. Right, and in both cases, what you find is that you have souls that were worthy of much more, but the generations were not worthy of them. But by the way, there is a third. If you're really going to go there, there is one more side to it, which I wasn't going to talk about. Again, the way that the Kabbalists look at this is that Moshe Rabbeinu really only was involved in Torah the last 40 years of his life. Rabbi Akiva was already involved in Torah from the middle 40 years of his life. So then what about the first 40 years? So there was somebody who was born a little more than 300 years ago who, as a child, claimed to have visions and claimed to have revelations and claimed that angels came and spoke to him and taught him Torah. And of course the Jewish community was completely frightened of him, and they excommunicated him and said that he's not allowed to learn or teach anything which is Kabbalistic till he turns 40. His name, ironically, was Moshe Chaim. The Ramchal.
And he died at the age of 39.
And he died before his 40th birthday. He came to Israel and he died. And the exact same thing happened, that the student said that this neshama was just too much. And he was mitaken the first 40 years of this life. And therefore he was called Moshe Chaim. He married somebody named Tzipora. In the ketuvah itself, it makes reference how he is fixing Moshe's life. Let's just go back and finish up. Again, it's this original. It's the first 40 years. It's the first 40 years that, again, Moshe doesn't start till he's 80. Rabbi Akiva starts when he's 40. So you need those first 40 years for both, if you will. But it's this original song. What we then noted was this death of Moshe was due to his hitting the rock instead of speaking to the rock. And then we saw this wonderful passage in Avot Rabbi Natan where Rabbi Akiva starts to study Torah, and he says his first Kal V'chomer, he starts to speak in learning, only when he sees the water which is going into the rock, which is an episode which I would say is the exact point where Moshe Rabbeinu stops. That's where Rabbi Akiva continues. And ultimately, the death of Rabbi Akiva is one of incredible, if not the, really, the, Kiddush Hashem that we, you know, we know that we point to Rabbi Akiva's death as being, you know, the almost the epitome of being Mekadesh Shem Shamayim, and therefore, if in any sense Moshe Rabbeinu's life was not what it should have been and was not Mekadesh as he should have been, so that we find then Rabbi Akiva is Mekadesh Shem Shamayim, and therefore that's what I think that Rav sees. Rav sees this connection between Moshe and Rabbi Akiva, and what this whole passage is really all about is to describe the greatness of Rabbi Akiva.
Now, can you put Hillel and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai in the same context to make the one leap?
Yeah, you could. You could.